Why Does E Equal MC Squared? And Why Should We Care? By Brian Cox and Jeff Forshaw.
This book has been made accessible under the Copyright Visually Impaired Persons Act 2002, 31B. Copyright in this recording for the accessible market vests in RNIB. Register charity number 226227.
Dedication. To our families, especially Gia, Mo, George, David, Barbara, Sandra, Naomi, Isabel, Sylvia, Thomas and Michael. Acknowledgements. We thank our management and agents, Susan, Diane and George, and our editors, Ben and Siska. Of our scientific colleagues, we should particularly like to thank Richard Batty, Fred Lobinger, Robin Marshall, Simone Mazzani, Ian Morrison and Gavin Smith. Special thanks to Naomi Baker, especially for her comments on the early chapters, and to Gia Milinovic for asking the question. Preface. Our aim in this book is to describe Einstein's theory of space and time in the simplest way we can, while at the same time revealing its profound beauty. Ultimately, this will allow us to arrive at his famous equation, E equals mc squared, using mathematics no more complicated than Pythagoras' theorem. And don't worry if you can't remember Pythagoras, because we will describe that as well. Equally important, we want every listener who finishes this little book to see how modern physicists think about nature and build theories that become profoundly useful and ultimately change our lives. By building a model of space and time, Einstein paved the way for an understanding of how stars shine, uncovered the deep reason why electric motors and generators work, and ultimately laid the foundation on which all of modern physics rests. This book is also intended to be provocative and challenging. The physics itself is not at issue. Einstein's theories are very well established and backed up by a great deal of experimental evidence, as we shall discover as the book unfolds. In due course, it is very important to emphasize, Einstein may be forced to give way to an even more accurate picture of nature. In science, there are no universal truths, just views of the world that have yet to be shown to be false. All we can say for certain is that for now, Einstein's theory works. Instead, the provocation lies in the way the science challenges us to think about the world around us. Scientist or not, each of us has intuition, and we all infer things about the world from our everyday experiences. If we subject our observations to the cold and precise light of the scientific method, however, we often discover that nature confounds our intuition. As this book unfolds, we will discover that when things whiz about at high speeds, common sense notions regarding space and time are dashed and replaced by something entirely new, unexpected, and elegant. The lesson is a salutary and humbling one, and it leaves many scientists with a sense of awe. The universe is much richer than our everyday experiences would have us believe. Perhaps most wonderful of all is the fact that the new physics, for all its richness, is filled with a breathtaking mathematical elegance. Difficult as it may sometimes seem, science at its heart is not a complicated discipline. One might venture to say that it is an attempt at removing our innate prejudices in order to observe the world as objectively as possible. It may be more or less successful in that goal, but few can doubt its success in teaching us how the universe works. The really difficult thing is to learn not to trust what we might like to think of as common sense. By teaching us to accept nature for what it is, and not for what our prejudice may suggest that it should be, the scientific method has delivered the modern technological world. In short, it works. In the first half of the book, we will derive the equation E equals mc squared. By derive, we mean that we will show how Einstein reached the conclusion that energy is equal to mass multiplied by the speed of light squared, which is what the equation says. Think about this for a moment, and it seems like a very odd thing. Perhaps the most familiar kind of energy is the energy of motion. If someone throws a cricket ball at your face, then it hurts when it hits you. A physicist would say that this is because the cricket ball was given energy by the thrower, and this energy is transferred to your face when your face stops the ball. Mass is a measure of how much stuff an object contains. A cricket ball is more massive than a table tennis ball, but less massive than a planet. What E equals MC squared says is that energy and mass are interchangeable, much like dollars and euros are interchangeable, and that the speed of light squared is the exchange rate. How on earth could Einstein have reached this conclusion? And how could the speed of light find its way into an equation about the relationship between energy and mass? We do not assume any prior scientific knowledge, and we avoid mathematics as much as possible. Nevertheless, we do aim to offer the listener a genuine explanation and not merely a description of the science. In that regard especially, we hope to offer something new. In the latter parts of the book, we will see how E equals MC squared underpins our understanding of the workings of the universe. Why do stars shine? Why is nuclear power so much more efficient than coal or oil? What is mass? This question will lead us into the world of modern particle physics, the Large Hadron Collider at CERN in Geneva, and the hunt for the Higgs particle that may lead to an explanation for the very origin of mass. The book finishes with Einstein's remarkable discovery that the structure of space and time is ultimately responsible for the force of gravity and the strange idea that the Earth is falling in a straight line around the Sun. Chapter 1. Space and Time. What do the words space and time mean to you? Perhaps you picture space as the blackness between the stars as you turn your gaze towards the sky on a cold winter's night. Or maybe you see the void between the Earth and Moon sailed by spacecraft clad in golden foil, bedecked with the stars and stripes, piloted into magnificent desolation by shaven-headed explorers with names like Buzz. Time may be the tick of your watch, or the reddening of the leaves as the Earth's yearly circuit of the sun tilts northern latitudes towards shade for the 5 billionth time. We all have an intuitive feel for space and time. They are part of the fabric of our existence. We move through space on the surface of our blue world as time ticks by. During the late years of the 19th century, a series of scientific breakthroughs in apparently unrelated fields began to force physicists to re-examine these simple and intuitive pictures of space and time. By the early years of the 20th century, Albert Einstein's colleague and tutor, Hermann Minkowski, was moved to write his now-famous obituary for the ancient arena within which planets orbit and great journeys are made. From henceforth, space by itself and time by itself have vanished into the merest shadows, and only a kind of blend of the two exists in its own right. What could Minkowski have meant by a blend of space and time? To understand this almost mystical-sounding statement is to understand Einstein's special theory of relativity, the theory that introduced the world to that most famous of all equations, E equals mc squared, and placed forever center stage in our understanding of the fabric of the universe, the quantity with the symbol C, the speed of light. Einstein's special theory of relativity is at its heart a description of space and time. Central to the theory is the notion of a special speed, a speed beyond which nothing in the universe, no matter how powerful, can accelerate. This speed is the speed of light. 299,792,458 meters per second in the vacuum of empty space. Traveling at this speed, a flash of light beamed out from Earth takes 8 minutes to pass by the Sun, 100,000 years to cross our own Milky Way galaxy, and over 2 million years to reach our nearest galactic neighbor, Andromeda. Tonight, the largest telescopes on Earth will gaze outward into the blackness of space and capture ancient light from distant, long-dead suns at the edge of the observable universe. This light began its journey over 10 billion years ago, several billion years before the Earth was formed from a collapsing cloud of interstellar dust. The speed of light is fast, but nowhere near infinitely so. When faced with the great distances between the stars and galaxies, light speed can be frustratingly slow. Slow enough that we can accelerate very small objects to within a fraction of a percent of the speed of light with machines like the 27-kilometer Large Hadron Collider at the European Centre for Particle Physics, CERN, in Geneva, Switzerland. The existence of such a special speed, a cosmic speed limit, is a strange concept. As we will discover later in this book, linking this special speed with the speed of light turns out to be something of a red herring. It has a much deeper role to play in Einstein's universe, and there is a good reason why light travels at the speed it does. We will get to that later on. For now, suffice to say that when objects approach the special speed, strange things happen. How else could an object be prevented from accelerating beyond that speed? It's as though there were a universal law of physics that prevented your car going faster than 70 miles per hour, no matter how large the engine. Unlike a speed restriction, however, this law is not something that needs to be enforced by some kind of ethereal police force. The very fabric of space and time is constructed in such a way that it is absolutely impossible to break the law. And this turns out to be extremely fortunate, for otherwise there would be unpleasant consequences. Later, we shall see that if it were possible to exceed the speed of light, we could construct time machines capable of transporting us backward through history to any point in the past. We could imagine journeying back to a time before we were born and, by accident or design, preventing our parents from ever meeting. This makes for excellent science fiction, but it is no way to build a universe. And indeed, Einstein found that the universe is not built like this. Space and time are delicately interwoven in a way that prevents such paradoxes from occurring. However, there is a price to pay. We must jettison our deeply held notions of space and time. Einstein's universe is one in which moving clocks tick slowly, moving objects shrink, and we can journey billions of years into the future. It is a universe in which a human lifetime can be stretched almost indefinitely. We could watch the sun die, the Earth's oceans boil away, and our solar system be plunged into perpetual night. We could watch the birth of stars from swirling dust clouds, the formation of planets, and maybe the origins of life on new, as yet unformed, worlds. Einstein's universe allows us to journey into the far future while keeping the doors to the past firmly locked behind us. By the end of this book, we will see how Einstein was forced to such a fantastical picture of our universe and how this picture has been shown to be correct in many scientific experiments and technological applications. The satellite navigation system in your car, for example, is designed to account for the fact that time ticks at a different rate on the orbiting satellites than it does on the ground. Einstein's picture is radical. Space and time are not what they seem. But we are getting ahead of ourselves. To understand and appreciate Einstein's radical discovery, we must first think very carefully about the two concepts at the heart of relativity theory, space and time. Imagine you are reading a book while riding on an aircraft. At 12 o'clock, you glance at your watch, decide to put your book down, leave your seat, and walk down the aisle to chat with your friend 10 rows in front of you. At 12:15, you return to your seat, sit down and pick up your book. Common sense tells you that you have returned to the same place. You had to walk the same 10 rows to get back to your seat, and when you returned, your book was where you left it. Now think a little more deeply about the concept of the same place. This might seem a little pedantic, because it's intuitively obvious what we mean when we describe a place. We can call a friend and arrange to meet up for a drink in a bar, and the bar won't have moved by the time we both arrive. It will be in the same place that we left it, quite possibly the night before. Many things in this opening chapter will appear at first sight to be pedantic, but stick with it. Thinking carefully about these apparently obvious concepts will lead us in the footsteps of Aristotle, Galileo Galilei, Isaac Newton, and Einstein. How, then, could we go about defining precisely what we mean by the same place? We already know how to do this on the surface of the Earth. A globe has a set of grid lines, lines of latitude and longitude, drawn onto its surface. Any place on the Earth's surface can be described by two numbers representing the position on this grid. For example, the city of Manchester in the UK is located at 53 degrees 30 minutes north and 2 degrees 15 minutes west. These two numbers tell us exactly where to find Manchester, given that we all agree on the locations of the equator and the Greenwich Meridian. Therefore, by simple analogy, one way to pin down the location of any point, whether on the Earth's surface or not, would be to picture an imaginary three-dimensional grid extending upward from the Earth's surface and into the air. Indeed, the grid could also carry on downward through the centre of the Earth and out the other side. We could then describe where everything in the world sits relative to the grid, whether in the air, on the surface, or below ground. In fact, we needn't stop with just the world. The grid could extend outward beyond the Moon, past Jupiter, Neptune, and Pluto, beyond even the edge of the Milky Way galaxy to the farthest reaches of the universe. Given our giant, possibly infinitely large grid, we can work out where everything is, which, to paraphrase Woody Allen, is very useful if you're the kind of person who can never remember where you put things. Our grid, therefore, defines an arena within which everything exists, a kind of giant box containing all objects in the universe. We may even be tempted to call this giant arena space. Let's get back to the question of what is meant by the same place and return to the aircraft example. You might suppose that at 12 o'clock and 12:15 you were at the same point in space. Now imagine what the sequence of events looks like to a person sitting on the ground watching the plane. If she sees the plane fly overhead at 600 miles per hour, she would say that between 12 o'clock and 12:15 you had moved 150 miles. In other words, you were at different points in space at 12 o'clock and 12:15. Who is correct? Who has moved and who has stood still? If you can't see the answer to this apparently simple question, then you are in good company. Aristotle, one of the greatest minds of ancient Greece, got it dead wrong. Aristotle would have answered unequivocally that it is you, the passenger on the aircraft, who is moving. Aristotle believed that the Earth stands still at the centre of the universe. The sun, moon, planets and stars rotate around the Earth attached to 55 concentric crystalline spheres stacked inside each other like Russian dolls. He therefore shared our intuitively satisfying concept of space, the box or arena in which the Earth and the spheres are placed. To modern ears, this picture of the universe consisting only of the Earth and a set of spinning spheres sounds rather quaint. But think for a moment about what conclusion you would draw if nobody had told you that the Earth rotates around the sun and that the stars are distant suns, some many thousands of times brighter than our nearby star, but billions and billions of miles away. It certainly doesn't feel like the Earth is adrift in an unimaginably large universe. Our modern worldview was hard-won and is often counterintuitive. If the picture of the universe we have developed through thousands of years of experiment and thought was obvious, then the greats of the past, such as Aristotle, would have worked it out for themselves. This is worth remembering if you find any of the concepts in this book difficult. The greatest minds of antiquity may well have agreed with you. To find the flaw in Aristotle's answer, let us accept his picture for a moment and see where it leads. According to Aristotle, we should fill space with imaginary grid lines centered on the Earth and work out where everything is and who is doing the moving. If we accept this picture of space as a box filled with objects, with the Earth fixed at its centre, then it is obvious that you, the passenger on the plane, have changed your position in the box, while the person watching you fly by is standing still on the surface of the Earth, hanging motionless in space. In other words, there is such a thing as absolute motion, and therefore absolute space. An object is in absolute motion if it changes its position in space, as measured against the imaginary grid fixed to the center of the Earth, as time ticks by. A problem with this picture, of course, is that the Earth is not standing motionless at the center of the universe. It is a spinning ball in orbit around the Sun. In fact, the Earth is moving at about 67,000 miles per hour relative to the Sun. If you go to bed at night and sleep for 8 hours, you'll have travelled over 500,000 miles by the time you wake up. You could even claim that in about 365 days, your bedroom would have returned to exactly the same point in space, since the Earth would have completed one full orbit around the Sun. You might therefore decide to change your picture a little, while keeping the spirit of Aristotle's view intact. Why not center the grid on the Sun? It's a simple enough thought, but it's wrong too, because the Sun itself is in orbit around the center of the Milky Way galaxy. The Milky Way is our local island of over 200,000 million suns. And as you can probably imagine, it's very large and takes quite a while to get around. The Sun, with the Earth in tow, is travelling around the Milky Way at 486,000 miles per hour, at a distance of 156,000 trillion miles from the centre. At this speed, it takes 226 million years to complete one orbit, and so perhaps one more step might be sufficient to save Aristotle. Centre the grid at the centre of our Milky Way galaxy, and you could be led to another evocative thought. As you lie in your bed, imagine what the world looked like the last time the Earth was here at this very point in space. A dinosaur was grazing in the early morning shadows, eating prehistoric leaves at the place where your bedroom now stands. Wrong again. In fact, the galaxies themselves are racing away from each other, and the more distant the galaxy, the faster it recedes from us. Our motion among the myriad galaxies that make up the universe appears to be extremely difficult indeed to pin down. So Aristotle has a problem, because it seems to be impossible to define exactly what is meant by the words standing still. In other words, it seems impossible to work out where to center the imaginary grid against which we can work out where things are, and thereby decide what is standing still and what is moving. Aristotle himself never had to face this problem because his picture of a stationary Earth surrounded by rotating spheres was not seriously challenged for almost 2,000 years. Perhaps it should have been, but as we have already said, these things are far from obvious, even to the greatest of minds. Claudius Ptolemaeus, known today as Ptolemy, worked in the great library of Alexandria in Egypt in the 2nd century. He was a careful observer of the night sky, and he worried about the apparently strange motion through the heavens of the 5 then-known planets, or wandering stars, from which the word planet is derived. When viewed from Earth over many months, the planets do not follow a smooth path across the starry background, but appear to perform loop-the-loops in the sky. This strange motion is known as retrograde motion, and had in fact been known for many thousands of years before Ptolemy. The ancient Egyptians described Mars as the planet who travels backward. Ptolemy agreed with Aristotle that the planets were rotating around a stationary Earth, but to explain the retrograde motion, he was forced to attach them to smaller off-center rotating wheels, which in turn were attached to the spinning spheres. This rather complicated model was able to explain the motion of the planets across the night sky, although it is far from elegant. The true explanation of the retrograde motion of the planets had to wait for the mid-16th century and Nicholas Copernicus, who proposed the more elegant and more correct explanation that the Earth is not stationary at the center of the universe, but in fact orbits around the Sun along with the rest of the planets. Copernicus's work was not without its detractors, and was removed from the Catholic Church's banned list only in 1835. Precision measurements by Tycho Brahe and the work of Johannes Kepler, Galileo, and Newton finally established not only that Copernicus was correct, but led to a theory of planetary motion in the form of Newton's laws of motion and gravitation. Those laws stood unchallenged as our best picture of the motion of the wandering stars, and indeed the motion of all objects under gravity, from spinning galaxies to artillery shells, until Einstein's general theory of relativity came along in 1915. This constantly shifting view of the position of the Earth, the planets, and their motion through the heavens should serve as a lesson to anyone who is absolutely convinced that they know something. There are many things about the world that appear at first sight to be self-evidently true, and one of them is that we are standing still. Future observations can always surprise us, and they often do. Perhaps we should not be too surprised that nature sometimes appears counterintuitive to a tribe of observant, carbon-based ape descendants roaming around on the surface of a rocky world, orbiting an unremarkable middle-aged star at the outer edge of the Milky Way galaxy. The theories of space and time we discuss in this book may well, in fact probably will, turn out to be approximations to an as yet undiscovered deeper theory. Science is a discipline that celebrates uncertainty, and recognizing this is the key to its success. Galileo Galilei was born 20 years after Copernicus proposed his sun-centered model of the universe, and he thought very deeply about the meaning of motion. His intuition would probably have been the same as ours. The Earth feels to us as though it is standing still, although the evidence from the motion of the planets across the sky points very strongly to the fact that it is not. Galileo's great insight was to draw a profound conclusion from this seeming paradox. It feels like we are standing still, even though we know we are moving in orbit around the sun, because there is no way, not even in principle, of deciding what is standing still and what is moving. In other words, it only ever makes sense to speak of motion relative to something else. This is an incredibly important idea. It might seem obvious in some sense, but to fully appreciate its content requires some thought. It might seem obvious because clearly when you sit on the plane with your book, the book is not in motion relative to you. If you put it down on the table in front of you, it stays a fixed distance from you. And of course, from the point of view of someone on the ground, the book moves through the air along with the aircraft. The real content of Galileo's insight is that these statements are the only ones that can be made. And if all you can do is speak of how the book moves relative to you as you sit in your aircraft seat, or relative to the ground, or relative to the sun, or relative to the Milky Way, but always relative to something, then absolute motion is a redundant concept. This rather provocative statement sounds superficially profound in the way that Zen-like utterances from fortune tellers often do. In this case, however, it does turn out to be a great insight. Galileo deserves his reputation. To see why, let's say that we want to establish whether Aristotle's grid, which would allow us to judge whether something is in absolute motion, is useful from a scientific perspective. Useful in a scientific sense means that the idea has observable consequences. That means it has some kind of effect that can be detected by carrying out an experiment. By experiment, we mean any measurement of anything at all. The swing of a pendulum, the color of light emitted by a burning candle flame, or the collisions of subatomic particles in the Large Hadron Collider at CERN. We'll come back to this experiment later on. If there are no observable consequences of an idea, then the idea is not necessary to understand the workings of the universe, although it might have some sort of chimerical value in making us feel better. This is a very powerful way of sorting out the wheat from the chaff in a world full of diverse ideas and opinions. In his China teapot analogy, the philosopher Bertrand Russell illustrates the futility of holding on to concepts that have no observable consequences. Russell asserts that he believes there is a small China teapot orbiting between Earth and Mars, which is too small to be discovered by the most powerful telescopes in existence. If a larger telescope is constructed and, after an exhaustive and time-consuming survey of the entire sky, finds no evidence of the teapot, Russell will claim that the teapot is slightly smaller than expected, but still there. This is commonly known as moving the goalposts. Although the teapot may never be observed, It is an intolerable presumption, says Russell, on the part of the human race to doubt its existence. Indeed, the rest of the human race should respect his position, no matter how preposterous it appears. Russell's point is not to assert his right to be left alone to his personal delusions, but that devising a theory that cannot be proved or disproved by observation is pointless in the sense that it teaches you nothing, irrespective of how passionately you may believe in it. You can invent any object or idea you like, but if there is no way of observing it or its consequences, you haven't made a contribution to the scientific understanding of the universe. Likewise, the idea of absolute motion will mean something in a scientific context only if we can devise an experiment to detect it. For example, we could set up a physics laboratory in an aircraft and carry out high-precision measurements on every conceivable physical phenomenon in a last valiant attempt to detect our movement. We could swing a pendulum and measure the time it takes to tick. We could conduct electrical experiments with batteries, electric generators, and motors. Or we could watch nuclear reactions take place and make measurements on the emitted radiation. In principle, with a big enough aircraft, we could carry out pretty much any and every experiment that has ever been conducted in human history. The key point that underpins this entire book and forms one of the very cornerstones of modern physics is that provided the aircraft is not accelerating or decelerating, none of these experiments will reveal that we are in motion. Even looking out of the window doesn't tell us this, because it is equally correct to say that the ground is flying past beneath us at 600 miles per hour and that we are standing still. The best we can do is to say, we are stationary relative to the aircraft, or we are moving relative to the ground. This is Galileo's principle of relativity. There is no such thing as absolute motion because it cannot be detected experimentally. This probably won't come as much of a shock, because we really do know it already at an intuitive level. A good example is the experience of sitting on a stationary train as the train on the next platform slowly pulls out of the station. For a split second, it feels like we are the ones doing the moving. We find it difficult to detect absolute motion because there is no such thing. This may all seem rather philosophical, but in fact, such musings lead to a profound conclusion about the nature of space itself, and they allow us to take the first step along the path to Einstein's theories of relativity. So what conclusion about space can be drawn from Galileo's reasoning? The conclusion is this. If it is in principle impossible to detect absolute motion, it follows that there is no value in the concept of a special grid that defines at rest, and therefore no value in the concept of absolute space. This is important, so let us investigate it in more detail. We have already established that if it were possible to define a special Aristotelian grid covering the whole universe, then motion relative to that grid could be defined as absolute. We have also argued that since it is not possible to design an experiment that can tell us whether we are in motion, we should jettison the idea of that grid, simply because we can never work out to what it should be fixed. But how then should we define the absolute position of an object? In other words, where are we in the universe? Without the notion of Aristotle's special grid, these questions have no scientific meaning. All we can speak of are the relative positions of objects. There is therefore no way of specifying absolute positions in space, and that is what we mean when we assert that the notion of absolute space itself has no meaning. Thinking of the universe as a giant box within which things move around is a concept that is not required by experiment. We can't overemphasize how important this piece of reasoning is. The great physicist Richard Feynman once said that no matter how beautiful your theory, no matter how clever you are or what your name is, if it disagrees with experiment, it's wrong. In this statement is the key to science. Turning this statement around, if a concept is not testable by experiment, then we have no way of telling whether it's right or wrong. And it simply doesn't matter either way. Of course, that means we could still assume that an idea holds true, even if it isn't testable. But the danger is that in so doing we run the risk of hindering future progress because we are holding on to an unnecessary prejudice. So without any possible means to identify a special grid, we are freed from the notion of absolute space, just as we have been freed from the concept of absolute motion. So what? Well, being freed from the millstone of absolute space played a crucial role in allowing Einstein to develop his theory of space and time. But this will have to wait until the next chapter. For now, we have established our freedom, but we haven't acted as liberated scientists just yet. To whet the appetite, let us merely state that if there is no absolute space, then there is no reason why two observers should necessarily agree on the size of an object. That really should strike you as bizarre. Surely, if a ball has a diameter of 4 centimeters, that is the end of the matter. But without absolute space, it need not be. So far, we have discussed in some detail the connection between motion and space. What then of time? Motion is expressed as speed, and speed can be measured in miles per hour, that is, the distance travelled through space in a particular interval of time. In this way, the notion of time has in fact already entered into our thinking. Is there anything to be said of time? Is there some experiment we can do to prove that time is absolute, or should we also jettison this even more deeply held concept? Although Galileo dispensed with the notion of absolute space, his reasoning has nothing at all to teach us about absolute time. Time is immutable, according to Galileo. Immutable time means that it is possible to imagine perfect little clocks, all synchronized to show the same time, ticking away at every point in the universe. One clock could be on a plane, one on the ground, one, a tough one, at the surface of the sun, and one in orbit around a distant galaxy. And providing they are perfect timekeepers, they will read the same time as each other, now and forever. Astonishingly, this seemingly obvious assumption turns out to be in direct contradiction with Galileo's statement that no experiment can tell us whether we are in absolute motion. Unbelievable as it may seem, the experimental evidence that finally destroyed the notion of absolute time emerged from the type of experiments many of us remember from school physics classes: batteries, wires, motors, and generators. To address the notion of absolute time, we must first take a detour into the 19th century, the golden age of discovery for electricity and magnetism. Chapter 2. The Speed of Light. Michael Faraday, the son of a Yorkshire blacksmith, was born in South London in 1791. He was self-educated, leaving school at 14 to become an apprentice bookbinder. He engineered his own lucky break into the world of professional science after attending a lecture in London by the Cornish scientist Sir Humphry Davy in 1811. Faraday sent the notes he had taken at the lecture to Davy, who was so impressed by Faraday's diligent transcription that he appointed him his scientific assistant. Faraday went on to become a giant of 19th century science, widely acknowledged to have been one of the greatest experimental physicists of all time. Davy is quoted as saying that Faraday was his greatest scientific discovery. As 21st century scientists, it is easy to look back at the early 19th century with envious eyes. Faraday didn't need to collaborate with 10,000 other scientists and engineers at CERN or launch a double-decker bus-sized space telescope into high Earth orbit to make profound discoveries. Faraday's CERN fitted comfortably onto his bench, and yet he was able to make observations that led directly to the destruction of the notion of absolute time. The scale of science has certainly changed over the centuries, in part because those areas of nature that do not require technologically advanced apparatus to observe them have already been studied in exquisite detail. That's not to say there aren't examples in science today where simple experiments produce important results, just that to push back the frontiers across the board generally requires complicated machines. In early Victorian London, Faraday needed nothing more exotic or expensive than coils of wire, magnets, and a compass to provide the first experimental evidence that time is not what it seems. He gathered this evidence by doing what scientists like to do best. He set up all the paraphernalia associated with the newly discovered electricity, played around, and watched carefully. You can almost smell the darkly varnished bench mottled with shadows of coiled wire shifting in the gaslight, because even though Davy himself had dazzled audiences with demonstrations of electric lights in 1802 at the Royal Institution, the world had to wait until much later in the century for Thomas Edison to perfect a usable electric light bulb. In the early 1800s, electricity was physics and engineering at the frontier of knowledge. Faraday discovered that if you push a magnet through a coil of wire, an electric current flows in the wire while the magnet is moving. He also observed that if you send a pulse of electric current along a wire, a nearby compass needle is deflected in time with the pulse. A compass is nothing more than a magnet detector. When no electricity is pulsing through the wire, it will line up with the direction of the Earth's magnetic field and point towards the North Pole. The pulse of electricity must therefore be creating a magnetic field like the Earth's, although more powerful since the compass needle is wrenched away from magnetic north for a brief instant as the pulse moves by. Faraday realized that he was observing some kind of deep connection between magnetism and electricity, two phenomena that at first sight seem to be completely unrelated. What does the electric current that flows through a light bulb when you flick a switch on your living room wall have to do with the force that sticks little magnetic letters to your fridge door? The connection is certainly not obvious, and yet Faraday had found by careful observation of nature that electric currents make magnetic fields, and moving magnets generate electric currents. These two simple phenomena, which now go by the name of electromagnetic induction, are the basis for generating electricity in all of the world's power stations and all of the electric motors we use every day, from the pump in your fridge to the eject mechanism in your DVD player. Faraday's contribution to the growth of the industrial world is incalculable. Advances in fundamental physics rarely come from experiments alone, however. Faraday wanted to understand the underlying mechanism behind his observations. How could it be, he asked, that a magnet not physically connected to a wire can nevertheless cause an electric current to flow? And how can a pulse of electric current wrench a compass needle away from magnetic north? Some kind of influence must pass through the empty space between magnet, wire, and compass. The coil of wire must feel the magnet passing through it, and the compass needle must feel the current. This influence is now known as the electromagnetic field. We've already used the word field in the context of the Earth's magnetic field, because the word is in everyday usage, and you probably didn't notice it. In fact, fields are one of the more abstract concepts in physics. They are also one of the most necessary and fruitful for developing a deeper understanding. The equations that best describe the behavior of the billions of subatomic particles that make up the book you are now reading, the hand with which you are holding the book in front of your eyes, and indeed your eyes, are field equations. Faraday visualized his fields as a series of lines, which he called flux lines, emanating from magnets and current-carrying wires. If you have ever placed a magnet beneath a piece of paper sprinkled with iron filings, then you will have seen these lines for yourself. A simple example of an everyday quantity that can be represented by a field is the air temperature in your room. Near the radiator, the air will be hotter. Near the window, it will be cooler. You could imagine measuring the temperature at every point in the room and writing down this vast array of numbers in a table. The table is then a representation of the temperature field in your room. In the case of the magnetic field, you could imagine noting the deflection of a little compass needle at every point, and in that way you could form a representation of the magnetic field in the room. A subatomic particle field is even more abstract. Its value at a point in space tells you the chance that the particle will be found at that point if you look for it. We will encounter these fields again in Chapter 7. Why, you might legitimately ask, should we bother to introduce this rather abstract notion of a field? Why not stick to the things we can measure? The electric current and the compass needle deflections. Faraday found the idea attractive because he was at heart a practical man, a trait he shared with many of the great experimental scientists and engineers of the Industrial Revolution. His instinct was to create a mechanical picture of the connection between moving magnets and coils of wire, and for him, the fields bridged the space between them to forge the physical connection his experiments told him must be present. There is, however, a deeper reason why the fields are necessary, and indeed why modern physicists see the fields as being every bit as real as the electric current and compass deflections. The key to this deeper understanding of nature lies within the work of Scottish physicist James Clerk Maxwell. In 1931, on the centenary of Maxwell's birth, Einstein described Maxwell's work on the theory of electromagnetism as the most profound and the most fruitful that physics has experienced since the time of Newton. In 1864, 3 years before Faraday's death, Maxwell succeeded in writing down a set of equations that described all of the electric and magnetic phenomena Faraday and many others had meticulously observed and documented during the first half of the 19th century. Equations are the most powerful of tools available to physicists in their quest to understand nature. They also are often among the scariest things most people meet during their school years, and we feel it necessary to say a few words to the apprehensive listener before we continue. Of course, we know that not everyone will feel that way about mathematics, and we ask for a degree of patience from more confident listeners and hope they won't feel too patronized. At the simplest level, an equation allows you to predict the results of an experiment without actually having to conduct it. A very simple example, which we will use later in the book to prove all sorts of incredible results about the nature of time and space, is Pythagoras' famous theorem relating the lengths of the sides of a right-angled triangle. Pythagoras states that the square of the hypotenuse is equal to the sum of the squares on the other two sides. In mathematical symbols, we can write Pythagoras' theorem as x squared plus y squared equals z squared, where z is the length of the hypotenuse, which is the longest side of the right-angled triangle, and x and y are the lengths of the other two sides. The symbols x, y, and z are understood to be placeholders for the actual lengths of the sides, and x squared is a mathematical notation for x multiplied by x. For example, 3 squared equals 9, 7 squared equals 49, and so on. There is nothing special about using x, y, and z. We could use any symbol we like as a placeholder. Perhaps Pythagoras' theorem looks more friendly if we express it as a crescent moon squared plus aeroplane squared equals smiley face squared. This time, the smiley face symbol represents the length of the hypotenuse. Here is an example using the theorem. If the two shorter sides of the triangle are 3 centimeters and 4 centimeters long, then the theorem tells us that the length of the hypotenuse is equal to 5 centimeters, since 3 squared plus 4 squared equals 5 squared. Of course, the numbers don't have to be whole numbers. Measuring the lengths of the sides of a triangle with a ruler is an experiment, albeit a rather dull one. Pythagoras saved us the trouble by writing down his equation, which allows us to simply calculate the length of the third side of a triangle given the other two. The key thing to appreciate is that for a physicist, equations express relationships between things, and they are a way to make precise statements about the real world. Maxwell's equations are mathematically rather more complicated, but in essence they do exactly the same kind of job. They can, for example, tell you in which direction a compass needle will be deflected if you send a pulse of electric current through a wire, without having to look at the compass. The wonderful thing about equations, however, is that they can also reveal deep connections between quantities that are not immediately apparent from the results of experiments, and in doing so can lead to a much deeper and more profound understanding of nature. This turns out to be emphatically true of Maxwell's equations. Central to Maxwell's mathematical description of electrical and magnetic phenomena are the abstract electric and magnetic fields Faraday first pictured. Maxwell wrote down his equations in the language of fields because he had no choice. It was the only way of bringing together the vast range of electric and magnetic phenomena observed by Faraday and his colleagues into a single unified set of equations. Just as Pythagoras's equation expresses a relationship between the lengths of the sides of a triangle, Maxwell's equations express relationships between electric charges and currents and the electric and magnetic fields they create. Maxwell's genius was to invite the fields to emerge from the shadows and take center stage. If, for example, you asked Maxwell why a battery causes a current to flow in a wire, he might say, "Because the battery causes there to be an electric field in the wire, and the field makes the current flow." Or if you asked him why a compass needle deflects near a magnet, he might say, "Because there is a magnetic field around the magnet, and this causes the compass needle to move." If you asked him why a moving magnet causes a current to flow inside a coiled wire, he might answer that there is a changing magnetic field inside the coiled wire that causes an electric field to appear in the wire, and this electric field causes a current to flow. In each of these very different phenomena, the description always comes back to the presence of electric and magnetic fields, and the interaction of the fields with each other. Achieving a simpler and more satisfying view of many diverse and at first sight unrelated phenomena through the introduction of a new unifying concept is a common occurrence in physics. Indeed, it could be seen as the reason for the success of science as a whole. In Maxwell's case, it led to a simple and unified picture of all observed electric and magnetic phenomena that worked beautifully in the sense that it allowed for the outcome of any and all of the pioneering benchtop experiments of Faraday and his colleagues to be predicted and understood. This was a remarkable achievement in itself, but something even more remarkable happened during the process of deriving the correct equations. Maxwell was forced to add an extra piece into his equations that was not mandated by the experiments. From Maxwell's point of view, it was necessary purely to make his equations mathematically consistent. Contained in this last sentence is one of the deepest and in some ways most mysterious insights into the workings of modern science. Physical objects out there in the real world behave in predictable ways, using little more than the same basic laws of mathematics that Pythagoras probably knew about when he set about to calculate the properties of triangles. This is an empirical fact and can in no sense be said to be obvious. In 1960, the Nobel Prize-winning theoretical physicist Eugene Wigner wrote a famous essay titled "The Unreasonable Effectiveness of Mathematics in the Natural Sciences," in which he stated that it is not at all natural that laws of nature exist, much less that man is able to discover them. Our experience teaches us that there are indeed laws of nature, regularities in the way things behave, and that these laws are best expressed using the language of mathematics. This raises the interesting possibility that mathematical consistency might be used to guide us, along with experimental observation, to the laws that describe physical reality, and this has proved to be the case time and again throughout the history of science. We will see this happen during the course of this book, and it is truly one of the wonderful mysteries of our universe that it should be so. To return to our story, in his quest for mathematical consistency, Maxwell added the extra piece, known as the displacement current, to the equation describing Faraday's experimental observations of the deflection of compass needles produced by electric currents flowing in wires. The displacement current was not necessary to describe Faraday's observations, and the equations described the experimental data of the time with or without it. Initially unbeknownst to Maxwell, however, with this simple addition, his beautiful equations did far more than describe the workings of electric motors. With the displacement current included, a deep relationship between the electric and magnetic fields emerges. Specifically, the new equations can be recast into a form known as wave equations, which not surprisingly describe the motion of waves. Equations that describe the propagation of sound through the air are wave equations, as are equations that describe the journey of ocean waves to the shore. Quite unexpectedly, Maxwell's mathematical description of Faraday's experiments with wires and magnets predicted the existence of some kind of travelling waves. But whereas ocean waves are disturbances travelling through water and sound waves are made up of moving air molecules, Maxwell's waves comprise oscillating electric and magnetic fields. What are these mysterious oscillating fields? Imagine an electric field beginning to grow because Faraday generates a pulse of electric current in a wire. We have already learned that as the pulse of electric current passes along the wire, a magnetic field is generated. Remember that Faraday observed that a compass needle in the vicinity of the wire is deflected. In Maxwell's language, the changing electric field generates a changing magnetic field. Faraday also tells us that when we change a magnetic field by pushing a magnet through a coil of wire, an electric field is generated, which causes a current to flow in the wire. Maxwell would say that a changing magnetic field generates a changing electric field. Now imagine removing the currents and the magnets. We are left with just the fields themselves, swinging backward and forward as changes in one generate changes in the other. Maxwell's wave equations describe how these two fields are linked together, oscillating backward and forward. They also predict that these waves must move forward with a particular speed. Perhaps not surprisingly, this speed is fixed by the quantities Faraday measured. In the case of sound waves, the wave speed is approximately 330 meters per second, just a little bit faster than a passenger airplane. The speed of sound is fixed by the details of the interactions between the air molecules that carry the wave. It changes with the temperature of the air, which is a measure of how fast the air molecules bounce off each other. In the case of Maxwell's waves, the speed is predicted to be equal to the ratio of the strengths of the electric and magnetic fields, and this ratio can be measured very easily. The strength of the magnetic field can be determined by measuring the force between two magnets. The word force will crop up from time to time, and by it we mean the amount by which something is pushed or pulled. The amount of push-pull can be quantified and measured, and if we are trying to understand how the world works, it should come as little surprise that we will want to understand how forces originate. In an equally simple way, the electric field strength can be measured by charging up two objects and measuring the force between them. You may have inadvertently experienced that charging up process yourself. Perhaps you've walked around over a nylon carpet on a dry day and then received an electric shock when you tried to open a door with a metal handle. This unpleasant door-opening experience occurs because you have rubbed electrons, the fundamental particles of electricity, off the carpet and into the soles of your shoes. You have become electrically charged, and this means that an electric field exists between you and the door handle. Given the chance, when you grab hold of the door handle, this field will cause an electric current to flow, just as Faraday found in his experiments. By carrying out such simple experiments, scientists can measure the strengths of the electric and magnetic fields, and Maxwell's equations predict that the ratio of strengths gives the speed of the waves. What then is the answer? What did Faraday's benchtop measurements, coupled with Maxwell's mathematical genius, predict for the speed of the electromagnetic waves? This is one of many key moments in our story. It is a wonderful example of why physics is a beautiful, powerful, and profound subject. Maxwell's waves travel at 299,792,458 meters per second. Astonishingly, this is the speed of light. Maxwell had stumbled across an explanation of light itself. You see the world around you because Maxwell's electromagnetic field drives itself through the darkness and into your eyes, at a speed predictable using only a coil of wire and a magnet. Maxwell's equations are the crack in the door through which light enters our story in a way that is every bit as important as the discoveries of Einstein that they triggered. The existence in nature of this special speed, a single, unchanging 299,792,458 meters per second, will lead us in the next chapter, just as it led Einstein, to jettison the notion of absolute time. The attentive listener might notice a puzzle here, or at least some sloppiness on our part. Given what we said in Chapter 1, it clearly makes no sense to quote a speed without specifying relative to what that speed is defined, and Maxwell's equations make no mention of this problem. The speed of the waves, that is, the speed of light, appears as a constant of nature, the relationship between the relative strengths of the electric and magnetic fields. Nowhere in this elegant mathematical structure is there a place for the speed of the source of the waves, or indeed the receiver. Maxwell and his contemporaries knew this, of course, but it didn't worry them unduly. This is because most, if not all, of the scientists of the time believed that all waves, including light, must travel in some kind of medium. There must be some real stuff that is doing the waving. They were practical folk in Faraday's mould, and to them, things don't just wave on their own with no support. Water waves can exist only in the presence of water, and sound waves travel only in the presence of air or some other substance, but certainly not in a vacuum. In space, no one can hear you scream. So the prevailing view at the end of the 19th century was that light must travel through a medium, and this medium was known as the ether. The speed that appeared in Maxwell's equations then had a very natural interpretation as the speed of light relative to the ether. This is exactly analogous to the propagation of sound waves through air. If the air is at a fixed temperature, then sound will always travel at a constant speed, which depends only on the details of the interactions between the air molecules and has nothing to do with the motion of the source of the waves. The ether must be a strange kind of stuff, though. It must permeate all of space, since light travels across the voids between the sun and earth and the distant stars and galaxies. When you walk down the street, you must be moving through the ether, and the earth must be passing through the ether on its yearly journey around the sun. Everything that moves in the universe must make its way through the ether, which must offer little or no resistance to the motion of solid objects, including things as large as planets. For if the ether did offer resistance to the motion of solid objects, the Earth would have been slowed down during each of its 5 billion solar orbits, just as a ball bearing slows down when dropped into a jar of molasses, and our Earth years would gradually change in length. The only reasonable assumption must be that the Earth and all objects move through the ether unimpeded. You may think that this would make its discovery impossible, but the Victorian experimentalists were nothing if not ingenious, and in a series of wonderfully high-precision experiments beginning in 1881, Albert Michelson and Edward Morley set out to detect the apparently undetectable. The experiments were beautifully simple in conception. In Bertrand Russell's excellent book on relativity written in 1925, he likens the Earth's motion through the ether to going for a circular walk on a windy day. At some point you will be walking against the wind, and at some point with it. In a similar fashion, since the Earth is moving through the ether as it orbits the sun, and the Earth and sun together are flying through the ether in their journey around the Milky Way, then at some point in the year the Earth must be moving against the ether wind, and at other times with it. And even in the unlikely event that the solar system as a whole is at rest relative to the ether, the Earth's motion will still generate an ether wind as it travels around the sun, just as you feel the wind on your face when you stick your head out of the window of a moving car on a perfectly still day. Michelson and Morley set themselves the challenge of measuring the speed of light at different times of the year. They and everyone else firmly expected that the speed would change over the course of a year, albeit by a tiny amount, because the Earth, and along with it their experiment, should be constantly changing its speed relative to the ether. Using a technique called interferometry, the experiments were exquisitely sensitive, and Michelson and Morley gradually refined the technique over 6 years before publishing their results in 1887. The result was unequivocally negative. No difference in the speed of light in any direction and at any time of year was observed. If the ether hypothesis is correct, This result is very hard to explain. Imagine, for example, that you decide to dive into a fast-flowing river and swim downstream. If you swim at 5 kilometers per hour through the water and the river is flowing at 3 kilometers per hour, then relative to the bank, you will be swimming along at 8 kilometers per hour. If you turn and swim back upstream, then relative to the bank, you will be swimming at 2 kilometers per hour. Michelson and Morley's experiment is entirely analogous. You, the swimmer, are the beam of light. The river is the ether through which the light is supposed to travel. And the riverbank is Michelson and Morley's experimental apparatus, sat at rest on the Earth's surface. Now we can see why the Michelson-Morley result was such a surprise. It was as if you always travel at 5 kilometers per hour relative to the riverbank, irrespective of the river's speed of flow and the direction in which you decide to swim. So Michelson and Morley failed to detect the presence of an ether flowing through their apparatus. Here is the next challenge to our intuition. Given what we have seen so far, the bold thing to do might be to jettison the notion of the ether because its effects cannot be observed, just as we jettisoned the notion of absolute space in Chapter 1. As an aside, from a philosophical perspective, the ether was always a rather ugly concept, since it would define a benchmark in the universe against which absolute motion could be defined in conflict with Galileo's principle of relativity. Historically, it seems likely that this was Einstein's personal view, because he appears to have been only vaguely aware of Michelson and Morley's experimental results when he took the bold step of abandoning the ether in formulating his special theory of relativity in 1905. It is certainly the case, however, that philosophical niceties are not a reliable guide to the workings of nature, and in the final analysis, the most valid reason to reject the ether is that the experimental results do not require it. There have been many attempts since Michelson and Morley to detect the ether, and all have yielded null results. While the rejection of the ether may be aesthetically pleasing and supported by the experimental data, if we choose to take this plunge, then we are certainly left with a serious problem. Maxwell's equations make a very precise prediction for the speed of light, but contain no information at all about relative to what that speed should be measured. Let us for a moment be bold, accept the equations at face value, and see where the intellectual journey leads. If we arrive at nonsense, then we can always backtrack and try another hypothesis, feeling satisfied that we have done some science. Maxwell's equations predict that light always moves with a velocity of 299,792,458 meters per second, and there is no place to insert the velocity of the source of the light or the velocity of the receiver. The equations really do seem to assert that the speed of light will always be measured to be the same, no matter how fast the source and the receiver of the light are moving relative to each other. It seems that Maxwell's equations are telling us that the speed of light is a constant of nature. This really is a bizarre assertion, so let us spend a little more time exploring its meaning. Imagine that light is shining out from a flashlight. According to common sense, if we run fast enough, we could, in principle, catch up with the front of the beam of light as it advances forward. Common sense might even suggest that we could jog alongside the front of the beam if we managed to run at the speed of light. But if we are to follow Maxwell's equations to the letter, then no matter how fast we run, the beam still recedes away from us at a speed of 299,792,458 meters per second. If it did not, the speed of light would be different for the person running compared to the person holding the flashlight, contradicting Michelson and Morley's experimental results and our assertion that the speed of light is a constant of nature, always the same number, irrespective of the motion of the source or the observer. We seem to have talked ourselves into a ridiculous position. Surely common sense would advise us to reject, or at least modify or reinterpret Maxwell's equations. Perhaps they are only approximately correct. Now, that doesn't sound like an unreasonable proposition, since the motion of any realistic experimental apparatus would cause only a tiny variation in the 300 million meters per second that appears in Maxwell's equations. so tiny indeed that perhaps it would have remained undetected in Faraday's experiments. The alternative is to accept the validity of Maxwell's equations and the bizarre proposition that we can never catch up with a beam of light. Not only is that idea an outrage to our common sense, but the next chapter will reveal that it also implies that we should reject the very notion of absolute time. Breaking our attachment to absolute time is just as difficult to grasp today as it was to the 19th century scientists. We have a strong intuition in favour of absolute space and time that is very hard to break, but we should be clear that intuition is all it is. Moreover, Newton's laws embrace these notions wholeheartedly, and even to this day, those laws underpin the work of many engineers. Back in the 19th century, Newton's laws seemed untouchable. While Faraday was laying bare the workings of electricity and magnetism at the Royal Institution, Isambard Kingdom Brunel was driving the Great Western Railway from London to Bristol. Brunel's iconic Clifton Suspension Bridge was completed in 1864, the same year that Maxwell achieved his magnificent synthesis of Faraday's work and uncovered the secret of light. The Brooklyn Bridge opened 8 years later, and by 1889 the Eiffel Tower had risen above the Paris skyline. All of the magnificent achievements of the Age of Steam were designed and built using the concepts laid down by Newton. Newtonian mechanics was clearly far from being abstract mathematical musing. The symbols of its success were rising across the face of the globe in an ever-expanding celebration of humanity's mastery of the laws of nature. Imagine the consternation in the minds of the late 19th century scientists when they were faced with Maxwell's equations and their implicit attack on the very foundations of the Newtonian worldview. Surely there could be only one winner. Surely Newton and the notion of absolute time would reign victorious. Nevertheless, the 20th century dawned with the problem of the constant speed of light still casting dark clouds. Maxwell and Newton could not both be right. It took until 1905 and the work of a hitherto unknown physicist named Albert Einstein for it to be finally demonstrated that nature sides with Maxwell.